Thank you. I am a very grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Catherine. And I want very much to thank the committee for being here. And I really am enjoying this very much. You've treated me very well, and you're very open to the Al-Anon family groups, and it's very much appreciated. I noticed the little switch here. I have to share with you, I got to loosen up a little bit. I always get real nervous about speaking. But I want to tell you a miracle that happened 2 years ago in this room. We came here to, I think it was Joe and Charlie were having a workshop. And so my husband and I and several other people came to just kind of go through that workshop. And when we were on a break, a friend of ours from Illinois called home to talk to his wife. And he said, hold on a minute. And there's a young man sitting in the back there, Scott, wave your hand. He was here and he said, Scott, I want you to talk to somebody. So he hands him the phone and Scott goes outside to talk to this lady. So the miracle of what AA and Al-Anon can do, she's in Illinois working a program in Al-Anon. He's down here working an AA program. They're married today and they're expecting their first child. And what I love about the fellowship, and I talk about the three A's, Lois used to talk about the three A's, AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, and what I love about the fellowship is that we get to see miracles like this happen. And I got to watch this young lady have a dream, and she went to school for that dream, and now she's living it. And I got to watch that. And when we come in here, I know for me, I felt... In our pamphlet, Understanding Ourselves, it talks about I felt unwanted and loved and alone. And I felt very much alone, and I thought I was very unworthy. And we get to watch each other grow, and we get to be each other's cheerleaders, and we get to learn how to walk through these steps and find that God of our understanding so that we can become usefully whole members of our families, of our society, and of this fellowship. So I am truly grateful for that. I also like to recognize the history of these three fellowships. It's been very moving sitting in here looking at all these pictures. So whoever the archivist is, I don't think I've met him, but thank you so much for bringing this and setting it up. I was watching and looking at all the pictures trying to figure out who was who sitting from that position, but now they're behind me. And it's like, okay, just like God, I got your back. And this is where we came from. And you're where we're going. You're our future. So now that I got that out of the way, Dot H was my very first Al-Anon speaker that I ever heard at the Georgia Al-Anon convention, and I don't even remember what year. But she talked about, thanks to this program, I don't have to plot murder, suicide, or revenge anymore. And I'm here to tell you, thanks to this program, I don't have to plot murder, suicide, or revenge anymore. And I did that. We were joking this morning before we came down here. I wanted to be the widow that everybody pitied. I had plotted the murder. But it was going to be such that they would think that it was an accident, or and I would be the poor widow that had to live with that. But yet the insurance money would be in the bank. So that's where I started when I got here. And thank God for this program that I now have compassion and love for those people in my family that suffer from a disease called alcoholism. And that is for people who have the actual physical allergy as well as living with the effects of. And I know a lot of people in AA don't understand about the Al-Anon program and living with the effects of. And I was at it was an eating meeting a couple years ago, and there was a newcomer AA over here, and they were talking about, the AA speaker got up there and talked, and then when the Al-Anon speaker got up, he says, oh my God, what, is she powerless over nagging? And I looked, I looked at him and I said, that too. And there was a young man in an elevator last night as we were going upstairs, and he said, what convention is that? Are you with the Critics Convention? And I thought, I said I used to be. He didn't get that. So finding humor in everyday life. But my life is so different today than it was when I walked through the doors. I grew up in this disease. I married into it, divorced out of it, and married into it again. And for the family members who live with the effects of, what are the effects of? Financial insecurity, infidelity, chaos, physical abuse, spiritual abuse, sexual abuse. All of that is the effects of, and I have all of that in my past. There are also people that, most recently, some people in my groups have gone for a holiday dinner, and someone, a member of their family, was not in a mood that they wanted to come. So they took a holiday dinner home to their loved one, and when they walked in, they walked into a bedroom where they'd blown their brains out. And the family member is the one that gets to see that, and they're the one that goes to clean that up, and they're there making the arrangement for the hazmat team. Those are some of the effects of living with a disease called alcoholism. It's not pretty. It's not pretty for anybody. This disease will take anybody at any time, and it doesn't care. This program will bring us back to being whole, useful members of this society and of our community and of our family. I cannot express to AA how grateful I am that you shared this program with the family members. It has changed my life, and it has changed the life of my husband and our daughter. And she is not a member of either fellowship, even though she probably could benefit. But she has benefited from our changing our lives through working a 12-step program. She's very grateful that we're here this weekend, and she is watching our dog, who is like the main part of our life right now, our little dog. So she's there watching that dog, and later on you'll see she is not someone that was anybody that we could depend on, especially for something that we cared about like that. So that's a part of a miracle. Even in her irresponsibility, there are moments of responsibility because of her gratitude for what you have given to us. I guess the best place to start is just to start, and since I already told you I grew up in this deal, a lot of things happened, and I'm not going to go into the details. It's important to know that incest is a part of my past, and part of what that did for me is I learned very quickly that my prayers to the God that I know today, but my prayers to the God I had at that time, was please hurry up and let it be over, and tomorrow it will be different. So that attitude I carried into every relationship I ever had. And then when I married into the first marriage, okay, let's go ahead and let this, whatever the argument was, let this hurry up and get over, and tomorrow it will be different. And then in the second marriage, where violence was very prevalent, it was, if I'm just real quiet and I'm real still, if I hurry up and let it get over, and tomorrow it will be different. Now, one of the things I got in touch with when I was listening to the speaker last night, I am a child who was coming of age in the 60s, and that was the whole Vietnam thing. And I can remember from the time I was very little, I loved to go. I just wanted to go someplace else. I didn't care where it was. I just wanted to go. And at that time, we used to be able to go to the Miami airport and get on the roof of the airport and watch the airplanes. And so that was like our big deal on Sunday. And so we'd go do that, and a friend of mine later on said, I know you like to go bye-bye. Well, what I did is I took that go bye-bye with every time there was a negative thing that happened in my home, it was time to move. And so we may, in our marriage with Bob and I, we may live in a place 6 months, and then when there was a violent occurrence or event, I don't know what they call it, but when something happened, then the next day I was ready. Well, if we move over here, this time it will be different. So let's just go someplace else, and this time it will be different. But I got into that, and last night when I was listening to him, I can remember I wanted to go, But I didn't have the guts to just go and do it. I had to have a reason to go. And so when I'm in my teens, you know, this was during the Vietnam War, and I can remember we had our Hall of Fame where all the soldiers that had died in battle were on the hallway at school. And so at that time, I loved to dance. I loved the 40s musicals. I loved Living in Fantasy because that was much easier. And I loved the patriotism of the World War II era. So I decided, I went with a friend of mine, he was going to sign up to enlist in the military, I guess it was the Army at that time. So I thought, what a great idea, I think I'll enlist. And my brother was in the military at that time, and that's the only time that I can remember that we've ever had a really strong connection, and he told me, you will not do that. Do not do that, it is not what it was before. For whatever reason, I heard him, but, you know, I wanted to go do something, so I got married, is what I did. First guy that asked me, I'm 17 years old, and off I go to California. And, of course, he was from an alcoholic family, and he was just beginning his drug addiction. He was just beginning that. He was a musician, and, of course, I wanted the bright lights and the fame, and I wanted to go to California and do all that. And I ended up being one of the wives. It was a family deal, and I very quickly got into the thing of, well, somebody has to work, so I'm the one that has to work. So I started then being the martyr. Poor me, I've got to go to work. He's in the bars all night having to mingle with everybody. That's what they do. They mingle, so they buy drinks, and then they don't come home. So that was kind of what started early on for me. And so he was the one we talk about in our literature about waiting at the window for the alcoholic to come home. He was the one that I would wait at the window, and he wouldn't come home, and he wouldn't come home, and he wouldn't come home. So I'd call the hospitals, then I'd call the bar, and he'd tell him, no, I'm not here, tell her I'm not here. And then he'd come home, and I'd be there waiting, and I'd see the headlights, and then I'd jump under the covers and cover my head and pretend like I was asleep. And that's what we do. And somehow I'm going to control his drinking that way. Made sense at the time. But we had a beautiful little girl born in that marriage, and I'm very grateful. That is my daughter that I referred to earlier. And we wanted her. It was not a mistake, and it's very important for me to tell her today that she was not a mistake. You know, we make mistakes in life, but we're not a mistake. And she was wanted, and we both loved her as the best we could, but here we are. We've got two kids trying to raise a kid. And in one of our pieces of literature, it talks about you have two children trying to live a deathly disease. And so that's what we were passing on to her. And we started with her. We started using her as a weapon to get at each other. And we did end up getting a divorce. For whatever reason, I had enough strength that I knew I couldn't live that way forever. But we started using her as a weapon to hurt each other. If he did something I didn't like, he couldn't see her. If I did something he didn't like, he was going to take me back to court. So we did that for a while. And then enters, as Barbara used to say, cunning, baffling, and powerful. That would be the man sitting against the back wall there. We get married, and it just escalates beyond anything I could deal with. And so I've got this violent one on one side, and then I've got this family that believes in ownership of persons on the other side, and we're tugging that little girl back and forth. So, of course, my answer is to run, just to go someplace else, because if you go someplace else, then it'll be different. But see, the problem was is that I took my daughter and I took my mother, who was living with me at the time, and I put them on an airplane, and we left. And I didn't tell my ex-husband where we were going. So we started living underground, is what I call it. And, of course, living with a very active, violent alcoholic, the paranoia is extreme. And so I can remember, God love this little child. She was, what, six? And we would drive to our apartment, and I'd have to get on the floor, and she'd have to get on the floor of the car, and he'd go in the house with the gun to make sure nobody was there, and then we could run inside. This is what we're teaching this kid, but that's how we lived. And so very shortly after we were married, I don't even know how many months it was, my ex-husband found my daughter, and he kidnapped her from school. And at that time, the police did not do anything about parental kidnapping. And so they took her from school. And as sick as I was, see, we were living in something we'd never lived in before, my daughter and I, because we take our kids with us. We don't leave them out of anything. We take them with us. And we were living in something we'd never lived in before. And in that moment when we were ready to send somebody down there to go get her again and bring her back up, there was a God moment that I didn't understand, but there was a moment of clarity when I knew that that was not the right thing to do. And so I left her with her father. And so what started at that point was this period of self-hatred, because how does a mother not have her daughter in her possession? Not possession, but in custody. And so I started hating him a little bit more. I started hating me a lot more. I started hating my life a lot more. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And I'm not going to go into any more detail with the violence other than the fact that the first time I got hit, I thought, how dare you, I'm leaving. And the last time I got hit, I knew that somehow it was my fault. And so that's where I was when I got here. I will share the last drunk because it's important for us to not ever forget where we came from. It was one more time we were moving, because remember, that's my answer. It's time to move. And so we were moving out of a condo into a house, and he was at the one place and I was at the other. And as always, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm on the phone with him. Are you drinking? And he's going, no, I'm not drinking. 7:30, I'm on the phone. Are you drinking? I've only had one. 7:45, I'm on the phone. Are you drinking? Catherine, I'm only going to have two. That was the size, and he tells me later it was one of those box things of wine, you know, whatever. But it was important for me later on to understand the different things that go on in alcoholism and to understand about alcoholism, because I went through that thing of, if he doesn't drink hard liquor, then he won't get mean. So somehow I'd try and control that, and I said, well, why don't we have wine tonight? And then he got mean on the wine. And then I thought, well, if that's going to happen, I'll get him beer. Then he got mean on the beer. And so it was important for me to understand the allergy concept, that it is the physical thing. And once I heard someone say one time that when the man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And that's what happened. And here I am trying to control an uncontrollable situation. I'm trying to make this person that no longer had control over himself understand one more time what I'm trying to tell you, that if you just don't drink, everything will be fine. But at that time, I'm talking to a disease called alcoholism, which I didn't know anything about. So that was the last drunk. And like I said, Bob, by the time he got to our new house, he was in a blackout. And I was trying to control that blackout one more time. And his sister was present with her newborn baby. He was just a few months old. He got married this past weekend, by the way. And it's just amazing to see that we survive. If you're living in something tough right now, it's not going to be forever. I think it's going to be forever, but it's not going to be forever. I can tell you that. Everything that I thought I could never get through, I got through. And today is just a memory. So he's there. The violence has erupted. His sister lived in this stuff growing up, so she knew to get out of there. I didn't know I could leave. I thought I had to stay and control it. But what happens to the family member? We had guns. We always had guns, and that was something that was new to me. And Bob would pull the guns out, and we'd play the Russian roulette. You know, he'd say, if I can't have you, nobody will have you. And if I can't have you, then I don't need to be here. And so we'd do that crap. And so we were there one more time, and I thought that if I could just be quiet enough and just not say anything, tomorrow it would be different. But this night, God reached down into our lives, and this night, for some reason, something snapped. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. And I went after the gun that night, and I tried to kill my husband. And see, I am one of those people. I am one of those women that would be in an institution right now. I would be in a federal prison for killing my husband. It didn't matter what was going on in the house. I would be there, and God reached down, and that didn't happen. That particular night, there were no bullets in the gun. And, yeah, because he's alive. He's sitting in the back. that particular night, there were no bullets in the gun. And I share that part because it's important for me to let people know that the family needs help as much as the alcoholic needs help. And without help, I will get to a point that all I want is it for it to be over. And I don't care how it gets over. I just want it over. So that was the night that he goes to jail for the first time. He was one of those drunks, you know, and I've heard it in meetings and I've read it that the yets, we were still waiting on the yets because he hadn't lost a job. Well, he might have. But he was still working. We still had a place to live. We still had a vehicle. He'd never been to jail. You notice I'm saying he. And so it was still the yes. So it can't be that bad. Well, he went to jail for the first time, and that was like a wake-up call for us. And I thought at that point it would be my time that I could leave, and I couldn't leave. Because you see, in this disease, we adjust, we readjust, and we maladjust. And what had become normal in my life, it had been abnormal, became normal. And that was all I knew. And I knew a man one time that talked about, you know, we fear the future, or we fear the unknown more than we fear the known. And so I stayed, and I came back to what I knew because I figured somehow I could manage it. So he goes off to treatment, and again, I thought, well, maybe I can go, and I didn't go. And so I'm in the bedroom. This is my drama part. This is the drama. I'm in the bedroom. I've cleaned up the whole bedroom. I've got myself all clean. The rest of the house is in a shambles because we're moving. And I get my little $2.99 bottle of wine and my box of Sleepies, and I'm going to kill myself with that. But of course, what's going through my mind is I have to look good when I kill myself because whoever comes in... So whoever comes in is going to see me. You know, they won't think it's me. But I can remember standing there and not being able to do it and hating myself just a little bit more because I couldn't do it. That is the hopelessness that the family members live with in alcoholism. I didn't want to stay, but I couldn't go. I had no choice. I didn't know what else to do. And so Bob gets into treatment. And we start that whole thing of, okay, if you want to see your husband, you have to go to this thing on Wednesday night. And I'm thinking, I want him dead. I don't want to do anything else for him. But I go to this thing on Wednesday night, and we're in a room full of people. It's about 30, 35 people. And we're going around the room, and everybody's one-upping the other person on how bad it is at home. And then there's this one voice. It's the voice of Al-Anon. And she says it doesn't have to be that way anymore. Didn't know what it meant, but it touched me somehow. And so I kept coming back. And then when it was time for him to get out of treatment, she said, honey, she says, go to the meetings in the community because there's health and recovery in the community. And if you stay here in the meetings, you're staying with those of you who are exactly like you. And a sick mind cannot heal a sick mind. So I started going to this place called NABA, and Bill and I were talking earlier. Bill talks a lot about plugging into God, and we know when I'm into God and when I'm not. I can remember that it was our miracle. It was like God put us in this house, which was a mile away from the treatment center and 2 miles away from NABA. Today I can look back on that. That was our miracle moment. That was when God did for us what we couldn't do. But I can remember starting to go and feeling the fellowship, and I didn't go because I thought I needed to be there, but I went because it was a place I could be safe for an hour. And then they have this little cafeteria downstairs. And so we go and we fellowship down there, and I'd talk to the women, and he'd talk to the men, and we'd do that. And some days I'd come in after work, and I'd see everybody sitting there, and there was this row along the wall under the windows, and I think, God, look at the miracles today. And then other days I'd come in, and I'd look at that, and I'd say, why don't you go get a job? And so today I know that's because I wasn't plugged into God. So that was the beginning of our path. That was the beginning of me starting to see that somehow I could gain control of my life. we stayed married. We stayed married one day at a time. I'd leave in the morning and I'd say, yes, I'm coming home tonight. That was the best we could do. It was the best we could do. I didn't know what else to do. I rented an apartment, but I didn't go. So we did that deal one day at a time, and he went to his meetings, I went to my meetings. And the miracle of the meetings is, even if you don't think you're getting it, you're getting it. Because I would go, and I would feel nice, and I'd start to feel better, and then I'd go home, and then I wouldn't call anybody, and then I'd start to feel worse. Then I'd go to the meeting, and I'd start to feel better, and then I'd go home, and I wouldn't call anybody or read any literature, and then I'd feel worse. And then I finally got it, that if you go home, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're crazy as anything, and you can't sleep, take a piece of literature and go read something. You know, change the mind. Change the mind. And at 9 months in recovery, Bob came in a week before I did, so we celebrate our anniversaries of recovery very close together. And at 9 months, I got home from work, and at that time, we didn't have cell phones. We had phones that were on the wall. Lyle, 57. I'm 57. I am a woman that will tell you my age. So I went home, the curtains were drawn, the phone was off the hook. He's sitting in the living room with the gun in his hand one more time. And he's looking at me and he's going, I can't stay sober. I can't do this, but I know I can't drink. And see, I sat in all those Al-Anon meetings all that time, not really understanding, not really wanting to be there. And I was able to look at him and say, I love you, but I cannot help you. And I left that house and I went to an Al-Anon meeting for me, not knowing what I was going to come back to. But today, you know, hindsight is wonderful. I was able to, today I can see that I got out of God's way. As long as I'm in there running interference, God can't do what God needs to do. And today I know that that was the day I turned my husband, an alcoholic, over to Alcoholics Anonymous in the care of God. And so what happened, because I got out of his way, he went to the NABA club, and those AAs stayed there with him until midnight when they knew there was a meeting at another place called Biscayne Club, and they took him to the Biscayne Club. That's when he had his spiritual awakening. See, had I stayed home one more time trying to make him okay, I would have interfered with his spiritual awakening. So that is very important for me to remember. And I got to understand that later with other members of my family. And that's the hardest thing that I think I have to work on daily, is getting out of God's way in my life and in the lives of the people that I love. So we started along this the happy trails of AA and Al-Anon recovery, wanting to be this married couple, not really wanting to be married, but wanting to be this married couple. Me letting him do his program, him letting me do my program, and it just became our way of life. And I started healing, and I started looking forward to coming home. And he started healing, and he started looking forward to coming home. And some of the old-timers that were there working with him, because I knew I couldn't tell him what to do anymore, not that I ever could, but I tried, I let some of the old-timers talk to him about track record and trust, and it was stuff I needed to hear. See, whatever trust we had was totally destroyed because of what we lived in. And so they told him, it's going to take a while. You're going to say you're going to do something, do it. And then the next time you say you're going to do something, do it. If you're going to stay after a meeting and talk, you call her and tell her where you are. It's not checking in. It's telling her where you are. And so I started trusting a little bit. And then I had to really start looking at myself and understanding that I wasn't always saying what I was going to do. You know, one of the things that I have a real problem with is overcommitting. And I'd say yes to this thing, and I'd say yes to this thing, and then I'd be in the middle of, I can't do either one of them, and I wouldn't do either one of them, and I wouldn't call anybody. So in Al-Anon, we have this slogan. It says, mean what you say and say what you mean, but don't say it mean. So I learned consistency there, and I started learning consistency with you. And a couple years in the program, our daughter came back into our life, and she was a teenager by then. It had been, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years since I'd seen her. And it was time for her to be part of, and it was time for me to get past whatever that guilt and shame was and to become a mom. So, of course, I was going to be the best mom and make up for 8 years and do everything possible to make life wonderful for her. Well, by 15, she was well into her own disease by then. And she also has that thing that I have, and she likes to go bye-bye. And she likes to run. And when she gets herself in a corner, man, she's going to be out of there in a heartbeat. So she's at our house, and she wants to live with us because Dad's not doing it right. And then if we're not doing it right, she wants to be with Dad. And then she wants to be back up with us, and then she wants to be with Dad. And so she's 38 now, and she's still going between Miami and Atlanta. But now it's because she just likes to go between. And I don't have to tell her. I just tell her, just be safe and let me know you're fine. But she was a runner. And when she'd get herself in a corner, she'd run. And she'd call me up, and I'd let her come back. And then she'd run, and she'd call me up, and I'd let her come back. And this went on. And it was really starting to mess with what was going on in our recovery home. And so Bob and I would get in these fights, and I'd scream at him, I am going to do everything for her that I did for you. And I told my sponsor that one day, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, you almost died for him. Are you going to do that for her? Are you going to start working this program a different way so that you can be an example of consistency in her life? And I thought, well, how dare you talk to me like that? So I started becoming a consistent force in her life. But I did. You know, you sit in the meetings and you hear, but it's different with the kids. You think you can divorce the husband, but it's different with the kids. There's a difference. There's a difference because somehow I'm going to make her hear. And so she'd be off and she'd call me and I'd tell her, don't you see what you're doing with your life? Let me get you into treatment. Blah, 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 blah. Then I wouldn't hear from her for 6 months. And then I'd hear from her and I'd start again. Don't you see what you're doing with your life? Come on, let's get you in treatment. And so finally, one of the women in the meeting said, why don't you just tell her, thank you for calling and let me know you're alive. So I did that. And so she'd call every 3 weeks. And then she'd call every 2 weeks. And then she'd call every week. And so now it's just a joke. When she's on one of her trips, we both do this. Whenever we're getting ready to go out of town, we call each other and we say, we're getting ready to go and I love you. Because I want the last words that I say to anybody that I love in my family to be, I love you. And so we do that. And then she'll call me when she gets there and she'll say, it's okay, Mom, I'm alive. And so we joke about it now. But it took us a while to get there. And what she appreciates today, what Bob and I have done, is we have become that consistent force in her life. She lives in a world that I don't understand. My daughter is a dancer in one of those nightclubs that scare me. But she's done it for a long time, and she understands the code that goes on there. And I had a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous talk to me early on when I started understanding what she was doing because she didn't tell me for a long time. And she pulled me over and she talked to me about the code. And she talked to me about the bouncers and she talked to me about how they looked out for each other. And so today, I turn her and her life over to the care of God, and I know that God's got her just like God's got me. I also know that sometimes people die out there from this disease, but I still know that God's got them. And it doesn't have to be me trying to save them. So we had all of that going on, and there's been healing. There's been so much healing in our lives. My mother died way before I came into recovery, and there was a lot of guilt as a result of that relationship. I got to make those amends to her through my mother-in-law. I got to be the best daughter I could be to my mother-in-law and to her sister in her last years, and that was very important for me. I got to learn the concept of for fun and for free. If you do it without a price tag, because as long as there's a price tag, they own you, honey. It's not about you owning them. It's about them owning you. I got to go through those steps, and I got to find that God of my understanding, and when I found that God that loved me no matter what, then I knew I could love me. And I love studying the steps. I love book studies. And when we go through the steps and the traditions, I found my code. I found my moral code. And in those steps, you give me the strength to live that moral code. And today, if I'm getting off the beam, there's one of the books I read that talks about being on the beam and being off the beam. And when I'm off the beam, I have a means to get back on the beam and not have to beat myself up for years because I made a mistake. And that's when I started hearing, you made a mistake, you're not a mistake. I love that. I love that. So the fact that Bob and I like to travel, both of us, not so much anymore, we're getting too old for this. 4 years in recovery, we wanted to, he had an opportunity to go to Nuremberg, Germany. So of course we both thought that was a great idea. And we talked to our sponsors, and our sponsors co-signed it, and so off we went. We thought we were going to Nuremberg for business. We went to Nuremberg for program. Bob went ahead, and he got connected with AA. It's a worldwide fellowship. Wherever you go, it's there. He got connected with AA, and when I finally got over there, he took me to these apartments in Nuremberg, and he said, there's somebody I want you to meet. And when I got upstairs to the door, no elevators in this building, by the way. I think it was four flights, five flights, something like that. We got up to the door, and this wonderful, beautiful woman opens the door, and she's got this huge bouquet of flowers. She says, welcome to Al-Anon in Germany. And it was, I'm home. So, of course, we go to a country where we don't speak the language, you know, because we can do anything. But she worked with me. She was with me. She worked with me. She had been praying for long-term recovery in her life. And at 4 years, we were the long-timers. So do you know how scary that is? At 4 years, we're still not sure we want to be here. You know, it's that four-year mark of grow or go. So we start working this program, and she lived on speaker tapes and Al-Anon literature. And I want to thank every person that is willing to be taped, and I want to thank the taper for doing that, because you have no idea how many lives are touched as a result of these speaker tapes. She lived on those tapes because it was putting a different idea in there. You know, coming in here, I just know one thing. I know how to survive, and I don't do it very well. And so I start hearing different ideas, and I start hearing recovery, and I start hearing people laugh about some of the stuff that went on, and I start hearing that families are put back together. And so many people live on that. And I had no idea, because, you know, they're all around. But when we were in Atlanta originally, I could go to a meeting every day if I wanted to. So I didn't need speaker tapes. So I got to learn about that over there. And I think the most important thing I learned is that we are all equal. Everybody in this room is equal, whether you've got one day or whether you've got 45 years. Because when I was over there, my daughter was in some kind of cult, and she ended up in Oregon, and they were sacrificing virgins. And I knew in my heart it wasn't an issue. But this thing, was, oh my God, it's her, and I wouldn't hear from her. So I went to this lady's house who had maybe 4 weeks in Al-Anon, and I said, I need to be with you. Bob can't help me with this one. I need to be with you. And she didn't know what to do with me because I was crying, and I was, ugh. And she's like, oh my God, you want coffee? Can I get you coffee? I said, no, let me help you clean or something. And in Germany, they clean every day. I mean, they wash the curtains every day. They mop the floors every day. So her form of recovery was not to clean every day. But I think that was the most valuable thing that I learned over there, is that I have got to be able to reach out to anybody anywhere. And that's what we say, let me be there when anyone reaches out. And she was there for me. I will always love her for that. This particular woman is no longer a member of Al-Anon, and it hurts. It hurts. Because, you know, you find a certain amount of recovery, and you find a certain amount of change, and life gets better, and then it hurts to know. But she was there for me, and I'll love her forever for that. And then the other thing I learned was that since I had been in Atlanta, and there was a meeting every day that I could go to, and I get to Nuremberg, and there was one English-speaking meeting a week, I thought, oh boy, this is not going to work. And so I had learned how to do meetings in our home like the pioneers had done when they first started. They had meetings in their home. I had learned how to do that. And then I found out there was actually a second meeting in that area. But see, they were boycotting the meeting because the two women that were there every week, whether anybody showed up or not, were not doing it right. As if any of us at a year or 2 years know what's doing it right is supposed to be. So I went and I made a commitment to show up every week at that meeting. And so I learned about commitment one more time. And as other people came and made a commitment, the meeting grew. And I also learned that just because something's not done the way it was done when I came into the program doesn't make it wrong. Okay, but there was one thing that I did get to learn how to do, and it was on the English-speaking meetings were on a military base. And so for the family members to get to see the GI who was in one of the treatment centers, they had to have what they called Al-Anon Week. And so what they did is they gave them the Al-Anon literature, had them read the literature, and then they tested them at the end of the week. So we got to start studying about the traditions, and then we had a little group of three women that went to the military people in charge of this facility and kind of talked to them about the traditions of Al-Anon. So it started changing. It started changing. And with more information and more knowledge, we get stronger and we get stronger. And I, like I said, I love the literature. I love reading. I just love it because there's so much in here that shows me how to be the very best woman that God wants me to be on a daily basis. So we're there, we're learning all sorts of stuff. We decide it's time to come back because Bob needed to get involved with a family business. And then a couple years later, I have the opportunity to go back to Germany, but to former East Germany, when the wall came down with a company I worked for, the speaker tapes. They had no infrastructure. I could not use the telephone. If there were meetings in that area, they were not English speaking because the second language was Russian. So I learned about getting how to do the trains, and I got on the train and I go 4 or 5 hours to get to a meeting that I was familiar with. But in between, it was the speaker tapes and the literature that saved me, because I could go to my room and I had a little portable thing and I could listen to the speaker tapes. And then I learned about Al-Anon's lone member. And I don't believe they do that anymore because we have the internet. But the lone member was real important because I could write it and make my connection. I had my connection with you, even though you weren't with me. And I'd send it off, and whether I got an answer or not, it didn't matter. For that moment that I was sitting there, you, me, and God, I was okay. And I knew that I could go out and do the thing that I was afraid to do the next day. And we were talking in the meeting this morning about the 12th step. I don't know, how am I on time? I'm okay. We were talking about the 12th step and learning how to do service outside of the rooms. And when I was in Nuremberg, this one lady taught me how to drive a stick shift, because I tried to have my husband teach me how to drive a stick shift while he was drunk in Atlanta, 5 o'clock traffic, going uphill. So I can remember pulling the brake up, getting out of the car, screaming at him, "You drive," and walking down the road. So I didn't like stick shifts. And so this woman taught me how to drive a stick shift. Well, see, I believe everything is connected, because when Bob went into treatment, I stood at my car in tears because I didn't know how to open the gas tank. See, when I got married, I turned my will and my life over to the care of an alcoholic, and I stopped doing things for myself. In between the marriages, I was a little independent, but, you know, that's where I started. Then not being able to drive the stick shift. Then Carola teaches me how to drive the stick shift. Well, when I ended up in former East Germany, one of my jobs was to go from this town in Magdeburg to Berlin Airport and to courier people back and forth from the airport. in a stick shift. And I can remember driving down that highway thinking, thank you, God. Thank you, God, that you allow me to get past those little fears that keep me paralyzed. See, the disease of alcoholism absolutely paralyzed me. I could not do the things that just normal people could do because I wasn't good enough and because it wasn't perfect. And so little by little by little, we help each other. And we help each other learn how to do just those little things that we're afraid to do. And know that, walk through the fear. They used to have an acronym, and I can't say what the first acronym was, but it was like the F, everything and run. I knew that. I knew how to do that. But then all of a sudden I heard, face everything and recover. That's fear. Walk through it. Face everything and walk through it. But I don't have to go alone. See, I can go to you. I can go to my God. And that's probably where I should go first. But sometimes I have to go to you to get to God. And then I can just walk through it. Because I've already lived the hell. I've already lived in the worst place I think I could ever live. And I've gotten through it. And I've seen women lose family members to this disease, through suicide or through watching them drink themselves to death. And you know what? In our piece of literature, it says, I think it's in our Blueprint of Progress, it says, and you get up the next morning and life goes on. And it does. And I have tools today to go and to do. I want to share with you something very recently that has happened with me. I have just celebrated an anniversary in this program. June is my anniversary month, and I always like to reflect and go back and remember and to recommit to this program. And I know for me, sometimes I get complacent, and life is good for me today. It's not perfect, and there are things out there. I have a sister who is drinking herself to death right now, and every time I see her, the last time I saw her, she was 89 pounds, and she's angry. And she's angry. And she just lost her very, very best friend and drinking buddy to pancreatic cancer. And she called me one Thursday. And I've learned because of this program, call in the morning, don't call in the evening. You know, some of those things. But she called me that evening, and she was so angry. And she's never forgiven Bob for being alcoholic. And so she was ranting and raving about all the alcoholics that have ruined her life. And she was just in a rage. And I'm listening and I'm internalizing. And my sponsor, I got off the phone and talked to her. She says, honey, just tell her I'm hanging up now. Some of the basics. I need you to help remind me of the basics. But then as I started reading in my literature, she was in pain because she lost her best friend. And that death was not all about me. And I was making it all about me. So I was able to call her back the next morning and tell her, I love you. And I'm so sorry that you lost her. And so as long as I can continue to use this program to do that, then I know that I'm doing God's will. She may never find this thing. She doesn't think she has a problem. But I see her not being able to process food, but she can drink. And right now, that's sustaining her. And that's something else that I have been able to see. Right now, that is what's keeping her alive. And I think her anger. and she likes to rule everybody. But so I'm watching her and my brother. I'm watching him die. He's dying from something other than alcoholism. And so it's not always perfect. But what you taught me is you taught me you're the one with the program. So I make a phone call, so that I can tell them that I love you, because that may be the last thing that they ever get to hear from me. You know, Dennis used to talk about, and I think he was talking about something other than this, he'd say, let the last time be the last time. But what I've turned that around to mean is that the last time I talk to you may be the last time I talk to you. So has it been a good talk or has it been an argument because I think it's all about me? So I've learned that recently, and I'm learning one more time This week was a difficult week for me because I had to have a conversation with someone I love that was very hard. It's still hard for me to see the truth as I see it and to tell you the truth as I see it in my opinion. And it's still very hard to do that because you just might not like me if that happens. But I see that I still struggle with that. I see I still struggle with staying in reality and knowing what I know. These steps gave me the power to know and not doubt this. Now, I doubt this all the time because this is not God. This is of God. And I didn't know that because in the past, that thing would start in my stomach and I'd ignore it and off I'd go. And the next thing you know, there was chaos. So today, because of you, I can listen to this thing in my stomach and go ahead and do what I know I need to do for me. I can't remember which piece of literature it is. I think it's Survival to Recovery. It talks about being willing to stand for ourselves but not against our fellows. That's an art. Because when I want to make it all about me, I want to crucify you. And so for me to be able to just stand up and say, this is important to me, or, you know, I love you, but I don't agree with you. Oh, my God. But being able to stand up in that way is very powerful for me, but I have to work a program every day in order to do that. Because if I don't, I will go back to being the little doormat. They used to call it? Dora doormat? And those early conventions I went to, it was so funny. They'd have all the different characters and they'd have the doormat. But see, also in our literature it says, I was arrogant, smug, and self-righteous, and dominating. So I've got this on one hand and I've got the doormat on the other. So no wonder our house was in chaos. And no wonder that little girl didn't know which way to turn. And I wanted to blame it all on somebody else. So I get to look at me. I get to make the changes. And I learned that the moment I walked through the doors of Al-Anon, life no longer became a have-to. It became a get-to.